Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Bradley Gerrard. How are you doing, Bradley?
I'm great, thanks, John.
Good. And Mark Robinson. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well, thanks, John.
Good. So it's been an exciting week on the markets. Mark has written the cover feature on the rebirth of battery technology, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But lots going on in the news. We've had some kind of progress on the Brexit front, which has obviously attracted most of the column inches. But some big stories on the markets as well. Let's start with them.
Sure thing. I mean, one of the bigger stories of the week, not necessarily Brexit related, but is Rolls-Royce, really. I guess we should sort of touch upon that, because Rolls-Royce has been fined £671 million, which is split three ways between the UK, US and Brazil. The largest portion is going to the UK, almost £498 million. And the fine was basically linked to bribery and corruption claims that were historic at the company.
Mm, there was a big documentary about it on the BBC recently. I presume it relates to all that.
Yeah, I mean, the Serious Fraud Office has been investigating this for a few years now. And, I mean, Rolls-Royce in their statement did say that the authorities highlighted how complicit Rolls-Royce had been with the investigation, how very helpful, and not in any way sort of obstructing the investigation. So they got a few sort of brownie points from that perspective, I suppose.
Well, it was in their interest, obviously, to get a quick resolution.
Well, absolutely. And the fine is obviously a big amount of money. In the UK's portion is actually the largest fine, I think, a UK company.
Well, I guess they were banged to rights as well, so no point arguing.
The corruption charges related to third-party intermediaries as well. So, I mean, it's one of these arm's length issues that we've seen with other companies over the last couple of years as well, which brings up the whole issue of using third-party marketing and sales sources.
Yeah, one wonders how rife this is throughout the rest of the aerospace and defence industry, but we can only speculate and we won't do that right now.
Well, no, I mean, pharma is another sector where this has cropped up in the last few months or so as well.
Indeed, and in fact, we have a big feature in the magazine this week written by Thorin Mohammed, who unfortunately has left the magazine now. But before he left, he left us a little gift, which is this theory about corporate scandals and what you should do as an investor when presented with such a thing. You know, should you bail? And actually, a lot of the time, it really, he argues, is dependent upon how the company responds to the scandal. And you know, and here, in the case of Rolls-Royce, they've kind of done it right.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, I mean, the shares rallied off the back of this yesterday. So clearly, that thesis is correct. So the investors are looking at what Rolls-Royce has done. They now know an absolute figure that Rolls-Royce is going to have to pay. They can factor that into their forecasts. And really, it just kind of means that now they kind of know where Rolls-Royce stands. And I mean, from a trading perspective, I mean, Mark wrote the piece, there are some positive trends going on with the business. So, you know, they've got this sort of, they've got rid of this dark cloud hanging over them. And now anyone looking at the stock can more clearly analyse it, because this problematic issue is now behind it. It's out of the way.
You could also argue that this is an unavoidable symptom of globalisation and moving into countries that don't have the same levels of corporate governance as, say, the UK.
Although that would be blaming it on the countries that Rolls-Royce is doing business in rather than Rolls-Royce itself.
Well, blaming on the fact that they haven't progressed as far as we have in terms of corporate governance.
I think you're on dangerous ground there, Robbo. Anyway, let's talk about the shares, because that's what we're here to do. So as you say, they bounced off the back of this. The overhang of this fine is gone. What do we think of them now?
Looking at the moment, I mean, up until the bribery allegations that came through in the last quarter of 2016, the company had reacted quite quickly to a number of problems, cut down unit costs, and were looking to allocate capital to the most profitable parts of the business as well. And I made a point in the article about their small-scale nuclear reactor program, which they're still trying to get some clarity through on the government. But it's these areas of the business that they didn't want a drawn-out confab relating to bribery issues when they've got these parts of the business that they're trying to progress, and they see these as growth areas. So if you've got this overhanging you, it's obviously not good for the group, which has had any number of problems over the last couple of years. The market reacted well to it, and we're certainly more positive on the stock than we were this time last year.
Yeah, I mean, they've had obviously a change of management in the last couple of years. Warren East, formerly of Arm, you know, and there's a lot of criticism of management generally at the moment, particularly around pay and currently their attendance at Davos. But, you know, this looks like Warren East is making a difference here.
Yeah, definitely. And as I say, they're moving into sort of areas beyond their core competency as well, which is seen as a higher margin and with more growth potential in the years to come. Plus, there's some good news for them on the civil aviation front. One of the ratings agencies, Fitch, came out the other day and said that deliveries will expand through 2017 and through 2018 as well, which augurs well for their top line too. And so the delivery scale and work rate is likely to pick up over the next couple of years at least.
Okay, good news. Let's talk about bad news. Well, let's start with Pearson. We can't ignore it. Obviously, we used to be owned by Pearson. And I think it's fair to say that this fourth profit warning in 5 years or 5 in 4? Either way, it's pretty horrible.
It was its fifth in 4 years.
So not a massive surprise that we are where we are with Pearson's day. What was a surprise was the severity of the share price fall.
Yeah, it was stark. I mean, when I was looking at the Megan's piece yesterday, it was down about 28%. I don't know where it finished the day at. But yeah, I mean, obviously Pearson, as you say, sold the FT not too long ago. Is also now selling Penguin Random House, which is actually a very profitable part of the business. And having had a brief chat to Megan yesterday, I mean, she kind of really sees this stock as one that's, I guess I'd characterise her argument as sort of saying it's been a little bit behind the times. Like a lot of Pearson's rivals are very digitally focused now.
And, so that's like Reed and... it's still called Reed? It's called something different now, isn't it?
Good, yeah.
It's got a different name now, which I forget. I think it's almost like an acronym. But and there are US equivalents as well, who are very, very, almost entirely based online. You know, they publish their journals and everything online.
And Pearson's still trying to flog textbooks then?
Well, yeah, but apparently not anymore. Part of the radical plan to...
Well, they're moving into used textbooks now.
Oh, that's right. Textbook rental.
That's right. The ones they couldn't sell in the first place.
Well, yeah, they're doing that too. So they're embracing this revolutionary online thing that apparently some people dig. And they're also setting up a second-hand book market, which again, there's a big company, I think, called Amazon, which is quite well known for doing that.
Freddie, I think this is the most cynical I've ever heard you.
I'm taking it from Megan's lead, really. She gave me an extremely cynical synopsis on the shares. It doesn't look fantastic for Pearson.
Well, the principal criticism of the group over the years is that they've been hiving off the most profitable parts of the group.
Yeah, but you say that, but you know, there is a counter argument that a business like Pearson should in fact focus. So, you know, it once was a sprawling conglomerate that owned all sorts of things, including the FT, including theme parks, if I remember rightly, yeah. And television channels.
Madame Tussauds.
And, you know, the focus has been tightened and tightened and tightened. And education is a kind of sensible thing to focus on. And actually, the argument I heard was focusing on education is not a bad thing to do. Setting off decent assets, getting a decent price for them to reinvest in education is a good thing to do. But the execution of the strategy has been utterly dismal.
And maybe the focus will now mean that the execution can be honed a bit more because they're only looking in one area, and maybe in 10 years time we'll be sat here sort of saying how great Pearson shares are. But here and now, as you say, it's more the market they're targeting is not a bad one. Education's not going to go away, we're going to keep that, but executing in that market has arguably been problematic for Pearson, judging it just by yesterday's share price fall. And it looks like it could be that situation for a while.
Yeah, anyway, dividends getting cut, which no one likes a dividend cut.
No, and that will have sort of augmented the share price fall.
Absolutely. Let's talk about more bad news before we flip back to good news. Premier Foods, again, looks like a company that's somewhat behind the times.
Yeah, I mean, as we were discussing before we went on air, sort of some of the brands are sort of traditional.
I once wrote a blog back in the days of chronic investor madness called Premier Foods 70s Kitchen Cupboard, because I saw a stock photography of their portfolio, and it was since Angel Delight and Mr. Kipling's Exceedingly Good Cakes. Yeah, I just remember all those brands as a kid, and it's like, and they haven't really changed.
Not a lot, no. There are some new brands, but yes, they have all those brands you just mentioned, as well as things like Bisto, Oxo, etc.
Well, Bisto, I mean, that's a 70s brand if ever there was one.
Yeah. But yeah, Premier Foods shares fell roughly 15% on an update yesterday, which was a profit warning. So the company said that their trading profit is expected to be 10% lower this current financial year. A big reason for that really is, as you sort of mentioned at the very start of the podcast, is Brexit. Cost, effectively. So the cost of a lot of its ingredients, rather, I should say, have risen dramatically in the past year. There was a note from a broker at Davy, and just picking a couple of ingredients. So sugar in sterling has risen 45% in the past 12 months. Butter up 90% in sterling. Those ingredients are incredibly important, obviously, to things like Ambrosia, Mr. Kipling cakes. I mean, they're going to be key ingredients, and they've risen so much. And so obviously, if you counter input cost price rises, there are different things you can do. You can cut your own costs, or you can put prices up. And it looks like Premier Foods is now going to have to do both. They've announced a £10 million cost-cutting programme this financial year and next. And there were reports before this update came out that they were going to raise some prices by probably mid-single digits on some products, not across the board, but on some.
Let's see if customers respond to that in a positive way by continuing to buy the products, which is doubtful.
Yeah, I mean, also what's interesting, what was in their own update was the branded sales, so of the likes of things we've just been discussing, they actually fell in the third quarter of their financial year, 3.8%. But non-branded, so products they make for supermarkets that don't have a brand on, rose 11.6%. And what that really says to me is that consumers are, or have in this instance, traded down, or just preferred supermarket versions, albeit they'll be made by Premier. As a consumer, you'd never know that.
Dangerous game, that, supplying the same customers with white label goods as your own branded goods. And we know Thornton's tried that.
Yes,
didn't work out too well for them.
And there's a bit in their update which to me is, I think, a bit worrying. So Premier Foods made 216 million mince pies last year, but the problem with that is that some of the volume actually switched from Mr. Kipling to non-branded, and obviously non-branded are highly likely to be lower margin for Premier Foods. So that's not a good detail, in my opinion.
No, I would tend to agree. I mean, you know, you look, there are businesses out there in the same sort of market who have coped with this pricing, this cost inflation of raw materials, because they have the ability to either manage their pricing a bit better, or just they've managed their cost base overall a bit better. Premier Foods is, you know, this could be a Premier Foods problem rather than a market problem.
Yes, I mean, because you have to just look back a few months ago where Unilever and Tesco had a very public spat over the price of Marmite. And Unilever, obviously, is a much larger company than Premier Foods, and it probably has a bit more punch behind it.
Funny enough, the last company to have a public spat with Tesco about the price of branded products was Premier Foods.
That was a prescient relevance then, wasn't it?
Indeed. And I think that ultimately resulted in Tesco refusing to stock Hovis for a while. Premier Foods lost the battle.
It seems extraordinary to me that Marmite comes into the equation as well, because that's just basically made from slurry from the brewing process.
Maybe true. That's why I like it so much. All right, enough Premier Foods. Anyway, the share price is down to 46p, 41p even.
41, yeah. 41p. It was just under 2 years ago, we put a bit of hope in the shares at 46p. And it's been a wild ride, really, especially last year, because there was a potential takeover offer which the company spurned in favour of this kind of tie-up with Nissin Foods, which is a Japanese business.
I think there's some unhappy people that they didn't take that offer now.
I think there were at the time.
They were publicly unhappy on the front page of the FT type unhappy.
Yeah, there were some people who were openly willing to quote and be quoted about the fact they weren't happy. They wanted McCormick, the US company, to go ahead and do the deal, but Premier Foods voted against it.
There you go. And obviously, what do you need when you face big cost inflation of raw materials? Scale. Yep. And deals like that bring that kind of scale. There you go.
Absolutely.
Isn't hindsight a wonderful thing?
Beautiful.
So let's get back to good news, because you've written this story on this page about dividends, and it looks like we could be in for a good year on the dividend front. And that's what everyone likes to hear.
It is, isn't it? Yep. Make everyone's day a little bit better. So the research comes from IHS Markit. And they're expecting total dividends for 2017, and that includes special payouts, to hit $92 billion this year. A big reason for the rise, up from $83.5 billion in 2016, is things like Glencore resuming its dividend, increases from BHP, oil and gas dividends obviously looking very good. And importantly, the companies which pay their dividends in dollars. There are, I think, as HSBC's dividend will be flat on a nominal basis, but as a UK recipient, it's actually an 11% rise or something, IHS Markets say, because of the now differential between the pound and the dollar.
And that's assuming that stays where it is.
Of course it does.
Well, yeah. Presumably cash flows on the increase because of sterling's decline as well.
Quite possibly, yeah. There are lots of the IHS market research is pretty good. It does go through all the sectors and points out some sort of key sectors where there'll be big rises, where there'll be perhaps small drags on things. So, arguably, some stocks to watch out for if you're an investor. Barclays is one of the few banks that's going to be cutting its dividend. In travel, EasyJet could find itself under a bit of pressure because it links its dividend payments to a certain metric of profitability, which people are expecting to fall this year. We do remain bullish on EasyJet, I will say. We do have it on a buy still. It's a long-term thesis, which I won't go into now. But IHS Markets Research is very good. And the gamblers, I should say. I mean, another fantastic sector for dividends. GVC is coming back to paying ordinary dividends after having a break last year, so that's another good hunting ground for income seekers.
Yes, vice.
Well, there's only about a handful of stocks, though, isn't it? That count for the lion's share of dividends, total payout.
Tobacco, Vodafone is a huge payer.
Miners as well.
The miners,
Shell,
and BP and Shell. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, Shell's interesting. Shell, obviously, we covered the prospects for Shell's dividend in a podcast recently that Alex Newman put together. He's done a podcast this week on Gulf Keystone, GKP. Got their chief exec in to have a chat. So there's a story in the magazine as well. We won't go into it now, but worth having a listen to that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great piece, a great interview, actually. And it's really good to have a sort of one-to-one thing to listen to for our audience.
Indeed, some interesting feedback from Gulf Keystone Petroleum shareholders below the line on that piece as well.
That's what you want?
Yeah, venting spleen in most instances. Okay, right, well, that covers the kind of main market news. I mean, just in the kind of grand scheme of things, obviously May's speech this week was interesting. It would be pretty well received, I'd say.
It was well received. But what's kind of interesting for me is that it's kind of been pitched as bringing a lot of clarity and a bit more certainty to the situation. And I agree with that mostly, but then just looking around the 7-day spread, you've got Fitch, the big ratings agency, saying they're not sure actually what this means for the UK's current AA rating with a negative outlook. So that suggests Fitch is a bit bearish on what Theresa May said. You've got Burberry benefiting heavily from the weak pound because a lot of the tourist shoppers are coming to Britain to take advantage of sterling's drop.
I find that so extraordinary. You're planning your holiday, you think, where are you going to go? Oh, Britain, yeah. The pound's cheap, and they've got a nice Burberry shop there.
All these New Yorkers did camping to come over the Atlantic to shop. There's no shops in New York.
It's bizarre.
It is bizarre. I find it. I wouldn't do it, but Burberry cite it as a reason for their beneficial sort of third quarter trading update.
Fine.
And then IMF as well has upgraded its growth forecast for the UK. So all in all, it's still all a bit confused.
Well, that's going to be a negative, isn't it? Given their recent track record.
Well, yeah. My point is that they've had to sort of increase their their vision of what UK growth will be like. So that's sort of positive. Burberry's doing well from the pound's fall, but Fitch is a bit bearish. So yes, there's a bit of clarity from what Theresa May wants now, and that's great. But there's still
her cake and eating it, isn't it? Her cake and eating it is what
it
all,
it almost
wants.
Sounds like nobody's got a clue.
Well, that's kind of where I'm going at.
I mean, the IMF obviously wasn't listening. The economists there were obviously not listening to their boss, Christine Lagarde, who said that Brexit could only be either bad or very bad. Anyway, she's been at Davos this week, bemoaning the travails of the middle classes, the poor squeezed middle
classes.
Has
she got an ankle bracelet?
No idea. No. Yeah, anyway, so an interesting week in the sort of the political economy.
Absolutely. I think if you want a very good summary, not necessarily good, an interesting summary, it's probably worth reading J.D. Weatherspoon's trading update from this week.
Because he's a big fan of the EU.
Tim Martin loves the EU, and he loves economists too.
Yes.
Just have a look at his update is just enjoyable reading.
Yeah, okay, I will. I always like a good, amusing chairman's statement. There were some corkers out there, and he's one of them.
He is a corker.
Okay, right, let's move on to the cover feature, which you contributed this week, Mark, and it's a good one.
Yeah, well, it was a long time in the making because it's...
You're telling me.
I was more or less on deadline on this one. I was just taking a look at the battery market, obviously, because from time to time we've been having a look at the rollout of electric vehicles, and we've also looked at renewable energy. And it occurred to me that from a technical perspective, the main impediment to the growth of these industries or the effective rollout has been that battery technology has failed to keep pace. Especially when you look at the devices, the modern devices that batteries tend to power now. And the conclusion, I guess, at the end of the feature as well, is that we're pretty much on a cusp now, I think, where technologies, a confluence of technologies and economics will make this an even more viable industry in the years to come. So I've gone and had a look at the existing battery technologies, and also looked at the spread of lithium ion. I've looked at a few investment options that we've highlighted in the magazine over the last couple of years, including going right at source. Alex Newman, who we mentioned before, was looking at Bacchanora Minerals, a lithium miner, back in 2015. And occasionally at the IC, we like to highlight the old picks and shovels argument, whereby you're better off investing in companies that make the relevant kit for a given industry.
Okay, right, let's go back to the beginning. You mentioned that the technology is improving, that the economics are making it now viable as the technology improves to start rolling out more battery technology on a much more widespread basis. Let's talk about the economics first.
Oh, well, it's purely down to economies of scale, really. I mean, with electric vehicles, the main criticisms, of course, relate to range and the amount of time that it actually takes you to recharge batteries. Now, these are obviously technical issues that that companies are still grappling with, but as we see an increase in the number of EV or electric vehicles that are making their way onto motorways, economies of scale kick in. As a result, the power packs, the types of thing that Tesla are making are falling in price, which again feeds into sort of R&D budgets, which allows companies to invest even more money. It was odd, really, because given the year of the oil price slump, which was midway through 2014, the next 12 months had the highest rate of investment in electric vehicles that we've ever seen. And this is with the oil price virtually collapsing as well. So it demonstrates that there's real appetite out there.
Well, it's not just about the price of the alternative, which is oil. It's presumably a high oil price encourages investment in alternatives. So
yes, it has done down through the years, but not only in battery technology, but other types of green areas of the economy.
So the other side of this this kind of the other big driver, you could argue, is environmental awareness. So the big push for reducing carbon emissions, reducing air pollution.
Well, yeah,
must be playing into to the continued rollout of battery technology as well.
Well, certainly the Communist Party in China have made this a central plank of their growth policy for the economy. The difficulty in China, of course, is that the regional assemblies have so much power, but the air quality in China's large conurbations is actually seen as a potential structural inhibitor to the economy. I mean, it's reached crisis point in many cities over there.
Absolutely. I've got to say, the air quality in London's not that great either.
No, but...
especially Lower Thames Street, which we have to cross every day.
Well, yes.
Worst in London.
Worst in London, so I believe, yeah. That's true. Yes, of course, a lot of readers will be looking at this and thinking, well, I mean, you know, how far advanced is the technology given the dual recall from Samsung last year, which recalled memories of Dell's problems a decade earlier. But it has to be said that even lithium-ion batteries, which have been around since the early 1970s, are becoming more reliable. The energy density is improving. And I think we really are on the verge now of a sea change in battery technology.
You mentioned graphene as well, which has the potential to improve battery technology further still.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of technologies out there vying with lithium-ion, and lithium-ion dominates the market in terms of small devices, car batteries, and so on. But there are a number of alternatives out there, and perhaps the most exciting one relates to graphene. It was a material that was developed in Manchester University. It has unique physical properties as well. It's a single layer lattice of carbon atoms, very little electrical resistance. And so the physics backs this up, but there's speculation that eventually this material could be used as a superconductor. Superconductors at the moment have to be run at near absolute zero temperature, so there's a lot of energy input, but the feeling is that graphene could actually work as a superconductor at room temperature as well. I give an example in the article as well, that they say that you could actually, if this was used as in a unit with a mobile phone, you could actually power a mobile phone just by the kinetic energy of you moving with the battery in your pocket.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
Amazing. Well, that's renewable as it comes.
Well, exactly. And there's a number of, there was an Australian a startup last year, a listed one that used graphene in a battery unit there, but they've had some technical problems since then. I mean, it was hyped out of this world when it first came out. But it's one area I think we're going to see some real movement over the next decade.
I mean, I guess that's going to be the difficulty for investors looking at playing the battery technology theme, is that you will see a number of startups, you will see companies coming to AIM promising to revolutionary performance from whatever products they're developing. Many of these are going to fail.
Well, exactly, and the weird part about it, it's a mature market in any way. I mean, the technology's been around for 150, 200 years in a sense. I mean, your car battery, or the likelihood that the battery you've got in your car at the moment is based upon 150-year-old technology. It really hasn't moved on at the same rate as other forms.
So, I mean, you can argue, though, in that case, why not just go for the biggest? Why not just buy Tesla?
Well, yes. Well, I mean, the point is everyone is buying Tesla. You look at the ratings as well, and they're sort of analogous to Apple when it was reborn, if you like. And people were saying all throughout Apple's growth as well that these ratings aren't sustainable. There's no way that the growth could match the forward earnings ratings, but Apple's proved us all wrong. And investors in Tesla will be hoping for the same thing as well. I mean, there is a mature market out there. You could look at companies like LG Chem and Panasonic, who are large producers of lithium-ion batteries, but also conventional battery technology as well. But of course, when you invest in a mature market, your returns are going to be obviously limited. There are relatively few options out there, and I guess if Elon Musk is that successful, I mean, it could restrict actually producers of power packs for cars as well, because I mean, there's high barriers to entry. I mean, there's no shortage of tech out there, there's no shortage of IP, but if you actually want to try and compete with these scale operators, it's very, very difficult.
So why not supply them? I think you talk about in your piece Bacanora Minerals, which is indeed supplying lithium to Tesla. That looks interesting.
Yeah, that was a great insight by Alex. I mean, like any other junior miner at the moment, they've had a few issues. I mean, you dig a hole in the ground and you just hope there's no water ingress. That's the story of mining. But I mean, they're heading along the road. They've got a tied-in agreement with Tesla as well. They're one of, I think it might be three other miners have got these tied-in agreements. So once they're up and running, there will be no shortage of demand. And in fact, there was a report in the press today about a potential Project N in Cornwall, where they're thinking of extracting lithium from underground water supply there. So, I mean, there'll be no shortage of demand, you know, once this Tesla gets on the road. I mean, his plateau rate is that he's trying to build enough batteries to service 500,000 cars, but when they get onto the full rate for the Gigafactory in Nevada, that should supply up to 1.5 million cars per annum.
Okay, I mean, we talked a lot about cars. What we haven't really talked about is how battery technology can find its way into the home. Also, something that Tesla's working on with the Powerwall.
The Powerwalls, yes. In fact, there's Powerwall 2, which has just come out to the onto the market at the moment. Which again. The technology here, the problem with renewable technology, as we all know, principally with wind-powered and solar generation, is that if the wind doesn't blow or if you're nighttime, you're not going to be able to sort of meet demand, you know. The idea, of course, is that you get large-scale industrial batteries or batteries for the home that allow you to store up that energy when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing, and then it can be used at periods of high demand. Now, this is quite an easy equation on the face of it, but there are technological challenges there. Elon Musk thinks eventually that he'll be selling more of these Powerwalls than he will Tesla Motors. So
makes a lot of sense. Yeah. There's another little company that you've had your eye on for a while that's in a similar field. It's not car battery technology. It's grid battery technology.
It's grid and off-grid technology. Red Tea Energy. I mean, a lot of our readers will be familiar with the company because it's been attracting an awful lot of comments on investor forums.
Well, always a worrying sign.
Well, it is. Yes, I mean, it's not necessarily positive. That's for sure. But actually, what they seek to do is doing this on a larger scale. So they've got three of their large units in operation at the moment, one on a remote Hebridean island, and they've got two in areas of Africa, I believe, that have no access to electric grid. But of course, it acts almost like a substation in a sense. The main advantage that we understand in terms of the Red Tea Energy technology is its chemical composition, which makes it far more stable than alternatives on the market, and also cheaper, substantially cheaper than anything that's on offer from rivals. Including the main, the market leader in this area, which is a German company, Gildemeister Energy Solutions. So it's a company that we're really going to be keeping an eye on. We were actually going to speak to the chief executive today, but he rang off sick, unfortunately.
Never mind. We can speak to him in the future. Look forward to hearing that. Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's a fascinating feature. I mean, it really is. I think this is. You're right to have identified this as a big trend to watch out for.
I think the point is here. I'm sure our readers are aware of this anyway, but it's certainly an area that they must be looking at because it's one of the real growth areas in the economy at the moment, or potential growth areas in the economy at the moment.
Yeah. Well, maybe plug it into the industrial strategy.
Indeed.
There you go. Right. Okay. Wonderful. Well, I think that pretty much wraps up what we want to talk about today. There's plenty more in the magazine, even though we haven't yet got into the meat of results season yet, which comes in a month.
Yeah.
Less than a month.
Yeah, a few weeks' time.
Always slightly terrifying. We've still got plenty in the magazine. Megan Boxall, as well as writing about Pearson, developing a cynical streak, which belies her age. Yes, thank you, Robbo. She's written about AIM companies this week, and what she describes as boring AIM companies, which perhaps isn't always the reputation that AIM has. So, safer bets on AIM in 2017. Algie Hall stock screen looks at his have-it-all screen. And funny enough, it's very house builder centric, this one. Have house builders really got it all? Who knows? Plenty in the personal finance and fund section, which they will no doubt talk about on their podcast tomorrow. All the usual tips, all the usual comment from Simon and Chris and Bearball and Nicole. We're reintroducing a column that you may remember, No Free Lunch, which will now be written by Paul Jackson, who you will have seen writing for the magazine for a while. He's now going to be writing this monthly about all aspects of management, pay and governance and reporting and everything that companies do wrong that we like to moan about. He's done a really interesting piece on Rentokil and how that company almost disappeared off the face of the earth and was kind of brought back to life by some very highly paid or potentially highly paid executives, and how there's a lesson to be learnt there around executive pay. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, well, head over to iTunes and give us a rating, a sign of your appreciation. And obviously, there's a lot more of our podcasts on there, various interviews, personal finance podcast, and plenty more will be coming throughout the course of the year. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Bradley, and thank you, Mark. Pick up the magazine in all good newsagents, recharge your portfolio, how to invest in the rebirth of battery technology, or get online and subscribe. And we'll be back again next week. See you later.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.